Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, good morning. Somewhere in the vaults of Queensland's Crime and Misconduct Commission, there's a bottle of whiskey in a velvet bag. For me, there's no better symbol of one man's stand against corruption than that bottle. The bottle was given to a policeman, Col Dillon, who's my guest for you today. It was intended as a payoff for something that was called at the time the joke, which was an entrenched system of police corruption. Well, Col Dillon blew the whistle on that corruption and feared for his family's safety in doing so. But it was just the most publicised act of bravery in Col's long career. Col's been standing up to bullies all his life, as a school kid and even as a postie. And he was the first Aboriginal man to enter an Australian Police Academy. He retired from the force with plenty of commendations, including the Australian Police Medal. And Col Dillon can give you a unique insight into policing, into power, and to human nature. Col Dillon, good morning.
Good morning, Richard.
You're a beer man anyway, aren't you, Col? Not a Scotch man. Isn't that right?
That's correct, Richard, yeah. I like a cold beer on a hot day.
Where is that bottle of Scotch anyway? I'm just guessing it's somewhere in the vaults. Do you know where it is?
Richard, I'm told, I thought it disappeared many years ago, but a young journalist approached me one day, this is many, many years later, and said, could I do an interview with you? And I said, yes, I said, I'm just about interviewed out. I said, about Fitzgerald. I said, but always wanting to help the young ones. So I said, yes. I said, you can interview me. And I said, what's it in relation to? And she said, oh, the bottle of Scotch. I said, oh, my goodness me. I said, haven't you got something a bit more substantial to talk about? She said, no, that's a fairly interesting topic. I said, look, I suspect, I said, that may have eased its way over some lawyers' tonsils, or half a dozen of them, I said, celebrating some of their victories out of Fitzgerald. I said, I think it's long dead and gone. And she said, well, she said, I've got news for you. She said, it's still alive. She said, it sits in a vault. She said, at the Crime and Misconduct Commission. I said, are you serious? She said, no. She said, I've been in there. They escorted me in. And she said, I had a look at it. I said, did they let you pick it up and examine it? I said, it may just be full of tea today. Black tea.
I think it ought to end up in a museum in a case somewhere. It just seemed to summarise all the police corruption at play, and it was such an amazing symbol of that period and of that time. I think it really all brought it home for many Australians watching that unfold 20 years ago. We'll come to that a bit later on. But I want you to give me a bit of a sense of your childhood, Col, before you joined the police force. You grew up on the Sunshine Coast in a large family?
A large family, Richard. I was the second eldest of 11 children. And I was born in the little sugarcane township of Nambour.
Where the Prime Minister's from.
Well, yes, the same hospital, actually. And Nambour, of course, Nambour was the only hospital in the district, so that's how come I was born there. Flounder never had one. But my formative years were spent in Flounder. I did my schooling there. I grew up there with my siblings and so forth. It was a beautiful little place. It was an idyllic place, and I have many, many, many favourable memories of it. You know, swimming, going down to Bullcock Beach, which was the still waters where I used to swim with my mates. Later on, when I became a bit braver, graduated to surfing at King's Beach, which was a beautiful surfing beach back then in my teens. Wonderful waves and so forth, and I think it's very tragic at the moment. I think it's been a victim of the oil sludge that's spewed out of the bowels of that big ship that was going up the coast.
That's truly horrible, isn't it? But how about your mum, though? Tell me about your mum. Because mum and dad, both of them, because 11 kids, they must have been tired, Col. 11 kids, that's a big job. Yeah.
Well, my mother, only a very small woman in physical stature, a little woman. And she had 11 of us, and all by natural birth. And my dad was a very big man physically, yeah, a very big man, very strong man. And my dad was a good worker, a good provider. He provided well for his family, for all of us. And my mother would have to be the most patient person that I've ever that I've ever seen in my life, because I can remember growing up in my 10 years, and well after my 10 years, I was very impatient, very, very impatient. And my mother used to speak to me in a quiet voice and saying, "Son, you've got to learn to be patient. Patience is a virtue." So it took a long time for me to take on board one of those very important traits of a mother, of being patient. Today, I'm very patient. It takes a lot to arouse me.
You're getting the hang of it now?
Oh, yes, yes, well and truly, yes. And I suppose if you talk about being laid back, well, in my case, I might be a bit too laid back.
Your dad started as a milkman, didn't he, Colm?
Yes, that was after the war. See, I was born at the end of the war, and my dad, he served overseas. He fought in the British Solomons, and he was in the Provost Corps as a military policeman. So after he came back, I believe that's when he bought the little milk run and so forth. And, I mean, he just barely eked out a living back in those times. The milk, of course, it wasn't like we have today. There was no sophisticated mechanisation to have pasteurised milk and bottled milk and milk in cartons and flavoured milk and all. It was just straight warm milk from the cows.
And it would go off on a hot Queensland morning too,
oh,
I suppose.
Absolutely, yes, yes. So, that particular little business that he had, it proved over time not to be sustainable and not to provide him with an income adequate enough to look after his growing family.
So what did he do, Colm?
Well, after that, he went into a hotel, worked in a hotel as a barman at Cloundra for quite a number of years, owned by a very good friend of his, a fellow named Paddy Stewart. They were great mates, and so he worked for his mate for quite a few years, and then the family was still increasing in numbers and so forth, so he had to consider getting out and pursuing work that was that paid better to be able to feed all those little mouths and so forth. So he ended up going to North Stradbroke Island, where he started working for a company over there called Consolidated Rutile Limited.
And that's the sand mining, isn't
that's
it?
That's it, sand mining. Yeah. Richard, yeah. So he was into the sand mining, he and a couple of my uncles and so forth. And, of course, back in those days, they used to just go out to the beach and they would shovel it off the beach, pretty much in the same way as you see the people
doing today,
shoveling the oil off Moreton Island. But that's how they did it. They shoveled it straight. They had to shovel it from the ground up into the rocks. It was very, very heavy, and it would be driven by these big old Blitz trucks overland into Dunwich, into the township of Dunwich, where the processing plant was, where it would be processed and then loaded onto fairly sizable boats to be taken up to Pinkenbar, where it was then further processed for distribution overseas.
Meanwhile, there you are going to school as a kid. Tell me about your first major encounter with a bully at school, Cole.
The first bully that I encountered, he lived on the route which I took to school every day, and I probably just five as very in prep one, as they called it, on my way to school. And he was a big fellow. And
why was he picking on you? Because you were Aboriginal or because you were just little?
Oh, just little. I think just a bully is a bully. And I mean, he just...
on whatever reason they want, don't
yeah,
they?
That's yeah, that's right. They just pick on small targets, ones that they think cannot or won't retaliate. They're very careful in picking their mark. So I used to go to school each day, and I used to leave later and later, hoping that he didn't want to be late for school to get into trouble, that he'd go before me, and so I'd have a free passage to get there unhindered by him. But I'd draw level with his place. I'd only get a few yards past it. Next thing, he was right behind me and shouldering me and pushing me and bumping me all the way to school.
Little mongrel.
Yeah.
What did you...
No, he was a big mongrel, not a little one.
What did you do about it?
Well, there was nothing I could do. I mean, he was much bigger than me, and I tolerated that for quite some time. It might have been a couple of years before he left that school and moved to another school, and then he was replaced by another bully.
It's almost like a job you inherit, isn't it? It's like a job you apply for, you know.
Absolutely.
Salary.
And by that time, we'd moved from the first place that I recall that ever having lived in Cloundra, we moved to another place, and of course very unfortunately for me, the route that I took to school, this other bully lived on this. The second bully lived on this route, and of course, he used to give me what for going to school and what have you. And then I suppose that finally the third bully was a very big fellow. He was I used to think that he could have been in one of those on one of those men's magazines, you know, flexing the muscles and so forth, like an Iron Man. And I used to think, well, gee, he seemed to be much older than us and more physically built. He shouldn't have been in school. He should have been out in the workforce somewhere. He used to shove me and push me around the school ground, and then one day it came to a showdown. I decided, well, enough's enough. You know, like, what am I going to do?
How old were you then, Cole?
I would have been about 11 or 12. And I can remember it getting me down, and I made a conscious decision that either I address the matter or that I pull out of school. And I had little chance of doing that. I mean, my mother wouldn't have let me pull out of school, and I never told Mum about this particular one. But one day we're there in the school ground playing football, kicking the football around, and just for no reason, he just come up in front of everyone, because he'd been playing on the other side, grabbed me and gave me a great big shove and pushed me over from the ground. So I stood up, and all his supporters were surrounding him on his side, backing him up and giving him support. And there was nobody in my corner, no one standing around me. And so then he's looking me straight in the eyes, and he just said, "I said you're gutless, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, no, I'm not." And he said, "Well, prove it." And I just threw a straight left, flush on his nose, and he just stood there and blinked his eyes. And I thought, my goodness me, like it didn't even affect him. That's what I thought. I thought, now it's his turn. He'll just make mincemeat of me. And it seemed like a lifetime though that I was waiting, but it was only probably about 2 or 3 seconds. His legs started to shake and his nose ruptured. It sprayed all over this beautiful shirt that my mother had made me. And it was the first day I'd wore it to school. And down he went. And then, of course, all his supporters moved around around to me and wanted to back me. I wanted to be my mate, and I just said, no, step away from me. And from that day on, I just made a conscious decision that I would never, ever kowtow to anybody from there on.
You know, Cole, the most creepy part of that story is his mates. You know, they're standing around him, and then they shift around you.
Yes, yes.
What does that tell you about human nature? It's not a good thing to conclude, is it, Cole?
It's not, Richard, no. It doesn't give you much faith in human nature. They can be very fickle at times.
Former police inspector Cole Dillon is my guest in conversation this morning. Cole, tell me about the man who inspired you to become a policeman.
The local policeman, and there was only one then back in that time. Clanra was a very small population we had, sleepy little coastal town. And the policeman back then was a gentleman named Frank Crawshaw. And he was a very good friend of my father's. They were good mates, and simply because, I suppose, he being a lone police officer, he had the job of policing or having to police the hotel. And of course, the fact was that there was never any trouble at the hotel, not with my dad there.
Not with your dad there?
No, there was never...
Your dad could keep the peace, could he?
Oh, yes, yes.
In his former role as a military policeman?
Yeah, well, yes. And I mean, he's a big man physically, and he's very capable man of looking after himself.
Wow. And if you can keep a Queensland pub quiet in the 1940s, then that's pretty impressive.
He had no problems, I can tell you. And this is conveyed to me later on by his mates, and they just used to tell me the stories about my dad. They said there was never any trouble while your dad was working the shift. But anyway, my dad just happened to mention one day, he said, that's the sort of man you should grow up to be like, meaning to say that he was a very decent human being, a very caring human being, always trying to help people, very well respected, very well thought of in the township. And I can remember sometimes I'd be with Dad, he'd pick me up and he'd sort of give me a hug and nurse me when I was a little fella, about four, because it was at that very tender age of four was when I decided that one day I'd become a police officer.
It's interesting. I'm just putting that story alongside the story of, I don't want to make too much out of this, but that story about you king hitting the bully. Did you want from then on to be a good and strong person? That's to be strong and good at the same time.
Richard, I'll just qualify that. It wasn't a king hit on the bully. The bully knew full well that it was coming. He invited me, just said, well,
fair enough.
Prove that you're not that you're not gutless, and so I did. So it wasn't a king hit.
All right, I beg your pardon. Yeah. Quite right. Yes, just that thing, it's good to be strong and good.
Well, yes, and I think that was one of the defining points in my life there, because I was so timid. I was a very timid, very shy, very quiet, and I was too. And from there on, it gave me, that particular day, that particular instance, gave me the confidence from there on that I wouldn't tolerate being pushed around, and that if I sent anybody else that that was in that position, like being bullied and so forth, well, I'd do the right thing and step in to try and help them.
And the man who inspired you to become a policeman from as a kid, once you joined the police force, did you meet up with him, Cole?
Yes, not until many, many years later. So I suppose when I first would have seen him, I was 4 years of age. He was there for a number of years in our township, then he got transferred away, and I'd never seen him after that. And then I joined the police force. So I went into, and there was no academy then. It was the Petrie Terrace Police Depot, up on Petrie Terrace. It was an old police depot. The academy was a long way off. So I joined there, did my training, and initially I got sent to Mitchelton out on the north side. That was my first station. And then to Roma Street. And then one night I was assigned as a driver to his car. And he knew me straight away. And he had a big smile, a beautiful smile. He always had this beautiful big smile on his face. And he said, and he told me the next morning we did the shift. He come and he seen me the next morning. He said, oh, I said, I went home last night and just told my wife, you know, he said, you'll never guess who my driver was in last night's shift. So he was real thrilled that I had decided to take up the profession of policing. And fortunately, I mean, he was getting close to retirement, so I only had probably about 12 months or so in his company, working a various shifts with him before he retired. And of course, and very sadly, I mean, he didn't have a very long retirement before he passed on.
One of Australia's most distinguished policemen and whistleblower, Cole Dillon, is my guest in conversation. To join the police force in those days, Cole, how old did you have to be? Was there a gap between when you left school and when you could join the police force?
Yes, Richard, there was. There was cadetship, and I think cadets on leaving primary school, and of course back in those days, very few people went on to high school. I mean, times were hard and so forth. I certainly didn't have the chance to go on. But they could join the police force and become cadets. So it was like an apprenticeship there, say going in at 14 or 15, and they would have to work up until they reached their 19th birthday. So they could be sworn in on the very day of their 19th birthday, but not before. And others, like myself, which we were called probationaries, we just come in off the street, so to speak. So we didn't do the cadetship. We'd just make an application, put it in, wait to be called up, and then you'd go in for your training, and you'd do your 3 months or thereabouts.
So there was a couple of gap years then for you, Cole?
Oh, yes, sure.
So how did you, given that it was always your intention to join the police force, how did you fill in the time, between?
Well, as I say, I never lost sight of that goal. I was determined that one day I would be. That was my passion in life to be. Although at one stage there I was almost swayed, but I think policing would have eventually won out. But I could have also gone into the Queensland Ambulance Transport Brigade, because I'd served a lot of time as an honorary ambulance bearer in Cloundra. But as I say, policing would have eventually won the day for me. So just after I left school, Richard, I had a lot of fill-in jobs, labouring jobs around Cloundra. Cloundra was starting to develop its infrastructure. They were starting to make better roads and put in culverts across creeks and so forth. So I worked with a number of construction firms in doing that, and I had contemplated doing an apprenticeship with a friend of mine. His father wanted to apprentice me in building houses. Well, once I got up on the roof and just trying to get across the bearers and so forth and that. I mean, it was too nerve wracking for me. I didn't like heights, and so.
So you had a crack at being a postie for a while.
Yeah, that came after. Yeah. So I tried painting and carpentering, and I didn't like the heights. I didn't like being up in roofs. And work was very scarce in Caloundra at the time. But as I say, Caloundra mainly relied on the tourist season to get it through the lean times. And so with work being scarce, I knew the postmaster there. Actually, his son went to school with me, and we were pretty good mates. When I was going to school in the primary school, and he called me in one day. He said, "Listen," he said, "how would you like to get a job in Ipswich?" That didn't really appeal to me, but I didn't want to offend him. I thought he's trying to help me, he's trying to get me work, and I thought, well, yes, I need a job. And he said, "Look," he said, "I know the postmaster." He said, "At Ipswich," he said, "if you'd like to." Go across there, he said, "I'll arrange it." He said, "And you can start there on a temporary basis," he said, "but you'll have to sit for exams later on to win a position." So anyway, going from Clowndra, where all my friends were, where I'd grown up, and I'd never been anywhere else virtually, like going to Southport was like going to Ipswich was like going to Timbuktu. And so I got there, and I was in a boarding house, and I got a job there delivering mail each day on a mail run, which I had about three savage dogs on my run. I just had a thing with dogs. We never got along, and they used to waylay me, and I used to waste time like you wouldn't believe. I mean, they'd eat up a lot of my time, and I was always the last mailman getting back to the post office with the irate postmaster waiting to give me a rev for...
I'm just thinking, God, now you're big enough to get down the street to not worry about bullies, and now you've got dogs on your case.
Dogs on my case, yeah. There's always something chasing me, Richard. Yeah, always something after me.
So how did you deal with the dogs that chased after you, Colin?
Oh, well, I had a few people that owned the dogs. A couple were decent. They were sympathetic towards me, so they made sure that they'd have their dogs tied up. And then I had the most savage dog, and the lady that owned that didn't care. She said, "He's got to have his freedom. He's got to be able to run around." And I thought, well, he doesn't have to be chasing me and trying to bite me every day. So anyway, one day I was coming along and coming up, and he was waiting for me like he did every day. He was waiting out faithfully on the footpath to try and bite me. And as I came up alongside him with my bike, I always kept the bike between he and I. As he's trying to get around me, I'd move one way, he'd move. And anyway, I swung the front wheel of the bicycle with all my strength. He had a long, sharp nose, and it got wedged in the spokes of the bike. And he was yelping, he was barking, and I thought, goodness me, I thought, well, if I don't get the sack over this, the woman will put in a complaint about it. She came out and said, "What have you done to my dog?" I said, "Well, nothing." I said, "He's trying to bite me." I said, "He's got his nose stuck in the wheel of my bike." And anyway, after that, Richard, he was never on the footpath again. Or I seen him once, and I'd blow the whistle from down the street about 500 metres away. He'd be gone.
So, Col Dillon, you got into the police force, and this is still before the 1967 referendum, isn't it? Before Aboriginal people were, you know, fully counted in the census and properly regarded as citizens in their own country. Was that a problem? Was that an issue for you to get into the police force?
Well, look, it would have been. It would have been. Actually, they could have said to me straight up, "Look, we're not taking you into the police force. It's as simple as that." And they would not have had to have given any excuses for non-acceptance. What happened was back in my hometown, when I'd decided time was getting close and I had to make my move to join. And, of course, I was in Ipswich at the time working, so travelling home every weekend and so forth. And that's where I signed the dotted line in Ipswich too, was to put my papers in to join the police force. I went home. I had to have two referees, and I just stopped in the thought, and I thought, well, gee, who could be a referee for me? So I thought I'd get my local priest. He was a fairly young joke, and we got on real well, so he was happy to be a referee for me, and then I needed another one, and I thought, oh. I racked my brain, and I thought, well, gee, I should front up and see if the local member might back me. And in all innocence, I mean, I thought, you know, I needed a referee, and I thought, well, I'll go and see him. I didn't know him. I'd never met him, but I knew who he was. I'd seen him on many occasions, as he would have seen me on the Saturday mornings. I'd be down the street with the ambulance there. We'd be running chocolate wheels and so forth to raise funds for the ambulance, and he used to stop and speak to the superintendent, so he'd seen me on quite a number of occasions. So just one Sunday, I was going home, and I drove up to his place, pulled up outside, walked in the front yard and up these big long stairs. It was an old Queensland, and he was sitting at the top of the stairs in this tiny little balcony there, taking in the afternoon sun. And I just went up and introduced myself. He was the Premier of the state also.
He was the Premier of Queensland. Did you know he was the Premier, Frank Nicklin?
Yes, I knew he was the Premier, but to me, I mean, I've been totally apolitical in my life. And of course, back then, as you know, I had no voting rights, but that never even occurred to me. I went up and introduced myself. I just said, oh, Mr. Nicklin, I'm so-and-so. I said, I was wondering if you might provide me with a reference. So I said, I'm wanting to join the police force. He never hesitated, didn't he? He said, I'd be very happy to, son. I can remember his words. He said, I'm very happy to. He said, I've seen you around. He said, you're a good young lad. He said, you do a lot of work, good work in the community. He said, so here you are. He said, I'll wish you all the very best. He said, and I'll follow your career with interest.
And what happened once you fronted up with reference from the Premier of Queensland? And I imagine that would have to be interpreted as an order, I suppose, if the Premier signs a reference for you.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I never thought like it. I just thought, hey, it's just a reference. And I remember going along. I had to go along initially to do an entrance exam. So I was just in civic clothes and had to take along my the referee reports. And I can remember the day I went there to the depot, to the front office, and I walked up and I presented them to a fellow who was a cadet working on there, and he took the paperwork, and when he looked at it, he said, is this for real? I said, what's that? He said, this is signed by the Premier. And it wasn't an impertinent remark by me, but I thought, well, he needs a response. I said, all you need to do, I said, is pick up the telephone, I said, and ring Parliament House and ask him whether or not he did provide. He said, oh, no need to do that. But
tick.
Yeah, but tick. But had it have not been for that report, Richard, I would not have got into the police force. I can tell you without a doubt.
And you must have realised that only many years later, I suppose.
No, yeah. No, I realised it.
Right there and then.
No, I realised within about 40 hours or so of having been there. What happened was I was in there, and a fellow, a staff member there who was a sworn officer but who was on the staff at the depot, he came to me one night very quiet, and he called me aside, and I suppose at considerable risk to himself, and he just called me and said, listen, he said, I want to tell you something. He said, for your own information, and he said that, do you realise, he said, you're the first person of your race to come through those gates, and I couldn't believe it when he said that. He said, I've got to tell you, they've got no intentions of keeping you in. He said, they want you out of the police force. He said, I've heard them speaking, which he would have done, saying that it's no place for blacks. We don't want blacks in the force. I was absolutely devastated. I was absolutely crushed by that. And as a matter of fact, I could have walked out there and then. It took me several days to sort of try and compose myself to get over that and make a decision as to whether or not I was going to stay there. And he also told me, he said, they've given an undertaking, or one particular fellow has given an undertaking that he'd have you broken and out within 6 months.
He'd have you what?
Say broken, like, you know, they'd break me and get me out of the force.
Break you? What does break you mean?
Well, break me means that they would break my spirit, that I'd end up doing something stupid, whereby they would have a lawful excuse to show me the gate to say, out you go, and that's it. And, of course, back in those times, there was no legislation in place. There were no anti-discrimination laws that I had recourse to. So I had to pretty much roll with the punches. But in having said that, that particular fellow who gave that undertaking of that he'd have me broken and out in 6 months, 36 years later, I was still in the force and he was long gone.
So that was the moment, I suppose, when you realised, so that's how it is.
Well, yes, I thought. And, of course, it clearly conveyed to me that, contrary to my beliefs in coming in there, I thought, well, the police force would be an absolute a place where only the people with the best principles, the best ideals, there'd be no such thing as racism. That's what I honestly believed, so much for my naivety.
Did you even know what racism was until
that
moment?
Yes, yes, yeah.
You're
but,
aware of it.
I had a little bit in the school grounds and so forth, but it was easy. It was like water for ducks. I mean, it was always hurtful. I've got to say, it was hurtful. It was painful, but I never had it to the
grown-ups.
No,
yes.
And it was an absolute shock to me to think that, well, here I am coming into a profession which was my life's passion, which I've always wanted to be in. Here I am coming into a profession and it's just entrenched with racism.
So, Col, you thought about leaving. Why didn't you?
Well, I suppose the saving grace there was the drill instructor, who was a disciplinarian, was a tough man, ex-British Navy. He was an Irishman. And he used to dish out the discipline like you wouldn't believe, and I used to get double. But one thing I knew was that I had a real ally in him. He'd be bucketing me with directives and so forth, screaming, yelling at me, and what have you. But when he got pretty close to me, he'd always walk past and say, "Good on you, son. You're going great." He'd whisper to me. He said, "You're going well, son. Hang in there." He said, "You're going good," and I thought, well, hey, he's in my corner, you know, and that inspired me. That gave me the confidence to hang in there. But many a time, for the first several weeks, I thought, like many others, for the first few weeks, Richard, when we entered there, the discipline was so strong. Fellows would go over the wall at night. You'd wake up in the morning, you'd see an empty bed alongside him, and they'd say, where's Frank? I said, oh, he was here for dinner last night. Better check his locker. You'd go to his locker. Locker's cleaned out. He's gone. He's shot through. They couldn't hack it. And I used to think, and I thought many a time at night, I thought, gee, if I was half smart, I'd go over the wall and keep going too. But I thought to myself, now, if I did that, I'd be doing that for the rest of my life. Every time the dreaded spectre of racism confronted me, I'd put my tail between my legs and I'd run. I thought, no, I will make a stand. I'll stay. And I did. And the day came for me to be sworn in. And when they had the parade, and we lined up in the parade, and it should have been perhaps one of the proudest days of my life. We're all there in our uniforms, spick and span, being ready to take the oath and be assigned our respective stations to go to work at. And as they were doing the parade inspection, the Commissioner of Police of the day was a fellow named Frank Bischoff, who is acknowledged as the father of corruption in the Queensland Police Force. As he was coming along, he purposely stopped in front of me and he spoke to the parade sergeant and said, "This fellow's a bit on the dark side to be in the ranks," and just moved on.
When the reverse was true, he was a bit on the dark side,
yes,
spiritually,
yes, spiritually,
morally, to
yes,
be in
yes,
the ranks.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, I was crushed again. I was devastated to think, well, that's come right from the very top. It must filter right down to the ranks, you know. And that was the case. It was a very, very racist force.
Were you very lonely in the early days in your police work, Col? You've been on your own?
Oh, yes. I've got to say, the first station that I got assigned to do my training was a great station. There was a couple of senior men there that were great to me. And as a matter of fact, my dad was there for my swearing in, and when we finished, we had to go to our respective stations. Make your own way there, however. My dad drove me out to Mitchelton on the north side, and one of the fellows that came out there, great man, and my dad said to him, he said, "Look," he said, "this is my son." He said, "Will you take care of him for me like that?" I felt a bit embarrassed about that. I thought, gee, Dad, like I'm a man now. I don't need anyone holding my hand. But he just said, and this fellow, and Jack Gill is his name, and I think he's worthy of a mention. And he just said to my dad, he said, "I'll look after him for you." And he did.
Col, when did you become aware of corruption and the joke, as it was called, which, as I've said before, is a term of, you know, bottomless cynicism. I think the term that was... had. It was the joke to describe the system of corruption and payoffs to police. And,
well, as you say, the joke. I mean, I never knew of the joke. I'd only knew of that term when Fitzgerald came about, that it was called the joke. But when I first became aware of it, and it was, I suppose, pretty much rumour and innuendo from pretty much the first day from when I first got in working, and you're driving around seeing your men, old, you know, like the older men and so forth, sergeants who'd been in the CI branch, they were disgruntled and so forth, had been passed over for promotion. You'd hear them talking because you were not allowed to speak to a senior officer. You had to wait for them to speak to you before you could speak back to them. And I used to sit there and hear them talking about bagmen. And the term bagman, I didn't know what a bagman was. I never had a clue. And I used to think, well, hey, is it a policeman dressed up as Santa Claus at Christmas time? Honestly, you know, that's what I thought. And they're talking about, and they mentioned three names. And, of course, one was the disgraced and former commissioner, Sir Terence Lewis. He was one. Another fellow was Glenn Hallahan. And another fellow, whose name I won't mention, so there were three of them, and they came to be known as the Rat Pack. But they spoke about them as being bagmen and so forth. And then later on, the government brought in a crime buster in Ray Whitrod. I think he came in around about 1972.
He was brought in from South Australia.
Yes.
The Premier of Queensland at the time, Joe Bjelke-Petersen.
No,
it was the police minister, I beg your pardon.
Yes, that's right. Joe never brought him in. That would have been the last thing Joe would have wanted. Max Hodges was the police minister of the day. He brought him in because Max Hodges was intent on cleaning up corruption. And so he brought Ray Whitrod in. And I was still very junior. I think I'd had about 5 or 6 years service up then and totally unaware about the supposed extent of corruption in the force. I mean, if you would have walked up to me and said, you know, you're working in a corrupt police force, I would have dismissed it and laughed it off.
Well, you weren't part of the club, were you, Carl?
No, never.
In a funny way, I suppose your aboriginality might have
excluded me.
Even protected you from it.
Yes, it did. Yeah, exactly. So yes, that gave me insulation from the corrupt practices that were going on. But anyway, to cut a long story short, I had my words with Commissioner Whitrod, and I must tell you this one, was that at that time, and I didn't know, I was working in what they call the Police Communications Centre, and there was a team of international journalists that came in, and they were going through the police department, but focusing on the police operations centre where I was working, and I seen them. I used to see them standing there with the cameras rolling and so forth, and thinking, you know, they're doing a program on policing, on different aspects of policing and so forth. And it wasn't too long after a friend of mine said to me, they said, oh, do you know why they're here? I said, yeah, they're doing on the operations of the community. They said, no, they're here, they're filming you. I said, you've got to be joking. They said, yeah. They said, they're intrigued by the fact that they've got an Aboriginal police officer working in this police force, you know, like the only one. And I couldn't believe it. And I was absolutely incensed at that. So I made arrangements. I wanted an appointment to see the Commissioner Whitrod straight away. Now, he hadn't been in Queensland too long, and he was bunkered down, let me tell you. And this is, I was told by other fellows that you had no chance of seeing him. He wasn't even seeing his senior officers because he was trying to sort out the wheat from the chaff in terms of who was corrupt and who wasn't. And as I say, I was naive to that, to know, you know, just what he was grappling with, what he was trying to clean up. But I said, look, I don't care how busy he is. I said, he's going to see me. And this was very brash and bold of me. I mean, I said, he'll see me, otherwise I'll go up and I'll put my shoulder through his door. Yeah, and Richard, this is gospel. So anyway, this inspector who I had to answer, he knew that he couldn't fob me off, and he said, well, look, he said, I'll make an appointment for you, and he did. He said, look, he said, you'll have to come in, he said, tomorrow afternoon. He said, the commissioner's happy to see you. So anyway, I come in the next afternoon, and his staff are standing outside the door. I knew them. They're still around today, too, these fellows. And they said, oh, the commissioner's waiting for you inside his office. They opened the door and they let me in. And I was worked up like you would not believe. And anyway, I cut loose on him and I was using expletives like you wouldn't believe. And he just sat there, he just listened, and he had his hands sprawled out in the dress like that, and he's watching me. And I said, look, I said...
And he's thinking, who is this man?
Yeah. And I said to him, I said, listen, I said, that minister you've got, because he gave the directive to the journalists to come in to be able to do what they could do, never coming to me, speaking to me. And I said, well, look, I said, I'm so angry. I said, you know something? I said, I could pick you up, I said, and bloody spear you right out the window. And this is now to the commissioner. And he put up his hands, he said, oh, and he had this high-pitched, squeaky voice. And he said, oh, no, son, he said that'd do both of us no good. And anyway, after he said, look, he said, you get it off your chest. He said, I can see you're upset. Anyway, cut a long story short, we came to an agreement there. He said, look, he said, no, he did the wrong thing. And he said, I want you to, no, I said, Commissioner, I said, I've overstepped the mark. I said, as a matter of fact, I said, I'm happy to hand in my uniform. I said, give you back my uniform, I said, for the way I've performed. He said, no, he said, I want men like you.
Yeah.
He said, I want men like you. He said, you get back to work, he said, and carry on with your work. Anyway, I never seen him until 1997. After that was
many
years later. I was in South Australia. I was heading for Port Lincoln. I was held up over the weekend, so I phoned him up, hopefully to see if I could just go and see him. I phoned him up, and he come on the line. I said, look, I said, you wouldn't remember me, Mr. Whitrod. And his old squeaky voice, he said, I'll describe you right now. he described me to a T. Yeah. And I said, I was just wondering if there'd be any chance of coming out to just see. He said, come out and see me. He gave me his address. He said, I want you to come out and see me. He said, only got an hour. He said, because he said, I've got blue nurses coming to see me and my wife. He said, but please come out and see me. I jumped in a cab, went out and seen him, and it was a sad scenario when I got there. His wife was totally blind in a wheelchair. He was in a wheelchair himself. I walked in. He said, look, he said, make yourself a cup of coffee. And he was that excited. He said, look, he said, tell me what's happening in Queensland, because he'd followed the Fitzgerald inquiry and he'd come up and give evidence himself. And he said to me, he said, son, he said, I'm so proud of you. He said, you finished off. He said, well, I started out the day.
And that's true. And that's exactly what happened. My guest today in conversation is Col Dillon, who was Australia's first Indigenous policeman. He rose to the rank of inspector and was a key figure in exposing systemic corruption in the police force in Queensland. We were speaking right at the beginning about that bottle of scotch. Col, just if you could just recount, I know you did this at Fitzgerald, but can you recount how that was given to you and what was said to you and the way it was given to you?
Well, that bottle of scotch, it was slipped into my locker, which I held the only key for. And, of course, that was very, very disturbing. I come to work one day, opened my locker. I had my service revolver in there and a number of sensitive files that I was working on. And when I opened it up, here's this bottle of scotch. I just glanced, my eyes swept the office to see if I was being watched at all. I couldn't see that I was being watched. I didn't know what to do, but I took it out and took it home. And I thought, well, you know, this is the setup, I'm being set up. But I took it home and kept it on the mantelpiece at home, hoping that one day, somewhere, sometime, there might be an inquiry, but honestly believing that there wouldn't be one in my lifetime. I mean, that's how I felt. But
how was a corrupt offer put to you? It was put to you.
Yeah, but listen, look, I've got to put the bottle of scotch aside. I mean, I wouldn't like to think anybody that I wouldn't like people to think that was my price. The bottle of scotch was that they give. I was offered the initial approach made to me was by a fellow officer there who waited one afternoon as I was leaving the office. Walked out, he caught me in the corridor, so I went to the water machine to have a drink. He walked up and he just said, "Listen, mate," he said, because by that time, I was a real thorn in their side. I was causing them big problems in the licensing bench, and that I was arresting people left, right and centre, the people that they were paying, who were paying big protection to be protected, to be able to run their rackets.
So someone received some instruction to do something about this nuisance?
Yes, that's right. So he said, listen, he said, mate, he said, how'd you like some extra money? He said, $400 a month. And, of course, $400 a month back then, that was considerable money. He said, $400 a month. He said, you've got nothing. He said, you don't have to do anything for it. He said, just have to turn a blind eye. He said, don't be in certain places at certain times. He said, that's all you've got to do. And my world just about, it opened up. I felt that I was being swallowed up. It was the most shocking feeling that I'd ever had in my life. And he just said to me, I knew I had to try and stall and bid for time. And I didn't want to rebuff him there and then, because I honestly thought, well, I mightn't make it home. That's how critical it was. I said, can I have some time to think about it? He said, I'll give you a week. He said, come back and see me. He said, don't bother going to the boss. He said, he won't know what you're on about. He'll look at you real stupid if you try and go and tip him off. And that was Graham Parker, who was very corrupt. And so I went to an old mentor of mine, an old sergeant that I used to work with, and who I'd kept in touch with ever since he'd retired. I used to see him pretty much on a weekly basis. I went and told him what had happened, and he said to me, he said, you're in a hell of a jam. And I said, what am I going to do? And he said, well, look, he said, one or two things. He said, you can draw him out and expose him. And I said, nah. I said, that'll be the end of me, absolutely. I said, I don't know how far it goes. I said, and he said to me, he said, look, he said, I'm concerned for you. He said, there's one person, he said, in there somewhere, he said, way behind the scenes, he said, who's very capable of seeing you get fixed up. And so I said, I've got to give him an answer, I said, by the end of next week, whether or not and of course, I meant, that was the furthest thing from my mind, I would never, ever take. I wasn't interested in being in their joke. And he said, well, he said, you either go back. He said, tell him, he said, that you're not interested. He said, but try and impress upon him and give him an assurance that you won't be a risk to him. So that's exactly what I did. He caught me a week later and came to me and said, have you thought over my offer and so forth? And I said, yes. I said, mate, I said, that's not for me. I said, I'm not interested. I said, by the same token, I said, I won't get in your way. I said, I won't cause you any trouble. I said, okay. He said, you've got nowhere to go to. He said, you know that. I said, yep, I said, I understand that. It didn't deter me. I went all the hard. I went out twice as hard to get the SP bookmakers and those that were running the...
It must have depressed you, though, Cole. That must have been. That's a depressing thing to hear.
Absolutely did.
It all came out as part of your testimony to the Fitzgerald inquiry, which is certainly one of its most dramatic moments, and you relating that story. During that time of your testimony, were you threatened? Was your family threatened?
Oh, yes. Look, after I took the stand, they and I'm talking about the officer responsible for looking after the police contingent at the Fitzgerald inquiry, who looked after the witness protection component of it, and they provided the crooks with 24-hour protection 7 days a week, and one was looked after for over a decade, and that's Jack Herbert. They never came near me once.
They protected Jack Herbert, the bagman.
And others too.
But not you. You got no protection?
No protection. They never come near me once. There was only one senior officer, and he wasn't too senior at the time, was Frank O'Gorman, Bluey O'Gorman's brother. Frank come to me and he just said, mate, he said, you've got some rough water ahead of you. He said, after taking the stand, he said, you know, I said, yep. He said, I'll give you my number. He said, day or night. He said, if anything happens, he said, give me a call. But, I mean, it was great of him to make that offer to me. But when it was all said and done, I mean, there wasn't much he could have done. And I had to look after myself, my family. At one time there, I thought my daughter had been kidnapped. I got this call from a fellow who just said, listen, he said, I got a call. He said, I think it's meant for you. He said, and this was a fellow who had the same name as me, who lived a few suburbs away. He said, we got this call saying that the caller said, we've got your daughter. He said, now we know where our daughter is. He said, do you know where yours is? And it was one of the sickest feelings I'd ever had in my life. I checked up and I found out that my daughter was safe, that she was at school. They were the sort of things that better. And I mean, this went on for quite a few years later, because it took a long time. I mean, the Fitzgerald inquiry ran for 2 years. It took that long to be able to cleanse out the system, to get rid of those police that had been adversely named within the system.
Cole Dillon is my guest in conversation. Cole, there's so much in your story. We really need 2 hours to do this, but Do you think, in the end, the Fitzgerald Inquiry did enough? Tell me what you think about the state of corruption in the state of Queensland now.
Well, look, today, Richard, and I make this crystal clear, today things are shocking in this state. Corruption still exists. It permeates right through the whole of government. And in saying that, I only need to allude to, and I point to, the matter of Heine. I don't know whether or not you've heard of Heine. That's the shredding of the Heine documents and so forth. That has absolutely brought to gridlock in this state our criminal justice system. It's paralysed it. And I can tell you what, it is not going to go away. I just hope the people that supported me, that heard me back when I took the stand at the Fitzgerald Inquiry, would be mindful of what I'm saying now, and I would make this appeal to them that they should go to their politicians and ask that something be done about this. Because there are five eminent judges across the nation, one a former Chief Justice, who are co-signatories to a letter saying that this is a matter that is unfinished business. There's a case to be answered and so forth. There's been a cover-up after cover-up by a succession of governments in this state. And until as such times as it's fixed up, our state will not be able to move ahead. It'll affect my children, your grandchildren, and the future generations to come. It's a boil that needs to be lanced sooner than later.
Just finally, very briefly, Cole, you're writing your autobiography. Will you finished anytime soon, I hope?
No, there's a bit of work ahead of me, but I am working on it, Richard, yes.
Cole, it's been great to meet you and fantastic to speak with you in conversation today. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Richard.
That's former Police Inspector Cole Dillon.
On ABC Local Radio. Conversations. With Richard Feidler.